BBC News.
And the news was read by Vigi Alice.
On BBC Radio 4.
That is weird.
Award-winning topical satire.
Hello, it's the Donald.
From some surprisingly familiar voices.
Laura's got the scent.
Oh. I can't come to the phone right now, as I'm busy scrutinising the detail of my hair.
Simples.
Dead Ringers returns.
Apparently Boris Johnson's what you end up with if you get Hugh Grant to play Donald Trump.
Sorry, am I making sense?
Dead Ringers, the 6:30 comedy for Friday nights on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And there's more award-winning comedy now on Radio 4 as we continue with Sarah Kendall's acclaimed storytelling show. The title of this instalment is 1:17 AM.
Hello, hi, I'm Sarah and welcome to my show. This is a show about luck. And how we interpret the events over the course of our life as being either good luck or bad luck. And how can we ever tell? So, my mum was over from Australia. She was staying with me recently. And we were watching the movie Dunkirk. I don't know if you've seen it. It's really intense. You know, there's a guy trapped on a beach and then he gets on a boat. The boat capsizes. The surface of the water is on fire. And then planes start shooting at him. And my mum says, he's bloody lucky they don't have sharks. In her mind, she'd already figured out how it could have been worse. See, my mum sees bad luck everywhere. She can find negative in anything, and I'm really trying to be more positive. See, for some people, the glass is half full. For some, it's half empty. For my mum, it's half empty, and you're frankly lucky if there isn't a shark at the bottom! I tell my mum I have to take the kid's hamster to the vet. So my mum stays home with my son, but I take my 7-year-old daughter with me to the vet appointment in South London. Our hamster's dying. Yeah, I got my kids a hamster because it's the pet you get when you can't be bothered getting a pet. It's just a hamster. And they've got all these selling points, you know, like they're meant to be completely odorless. Not ours. He's the size of my hand. He smells like a goddamn seal colony. Hamsters are also meant to be asleep like 18 hours a day. Ours never slept. Like, I'd be up in the middle of the night, I'd be wandering around the house and I'd go and look into Roo's cage just to see if he was asleep. And my kids had put a little Lego bus stop in his cage. And I'd look in 2 in the morning. Roo would just be sitting at the little Lego bus stop. Just waiting for the bus that was never coming. And I'd look into Roo's cage, I'd be like, what is wrong with you? Why aren't you asleep? Which must have been incredibly unnerving for Roo the hamster. Imagine if you were sitting at a bus stop with all your shopping and your gear and an enormous me in a Guinness shirt and no pants just came out of the sky. What is wrong with you? So we're at the vet's and the vet takes off the stethoscope and says to me, I'm afraid Roo has got an infection that's spread through all of his internal organs. Oh my God, this is the death chat. I've brought my 7-year-old kid in here and this is the death chat. I mean, this is a really important conversation. The death of a pet teaches a child how to deal with grief. It's a really important story. So I say to my daughter, I say, Viv, Roo was a very brave little hamster. He did smell weird and he didn't like being picked up. But he's in a lot of pain, so we've got to let him go. It's time for him to go to hamster heaven. My daughter's gazing up at me and I'm looking down at her and I'm already thinking, this is such a beautiful moment. Bet she remembers this at my funeral. She'll be all middle-aged. The church will be rammed. And my daughter will do this beautiful speech because I've used a story to teach her how to deal with grief right here in this moment. My mother was a very brave woman. She did smell weird. And she didn't like being picked up. But now it's time for her to go to hamster heaven. And then suddenly I realised the vet's looking at me waiting for me to say something. I just completely missed what was going on, you know, because I'm so excited about my funeral. And I say, I'm sorry, what? And the vet says, I just said the good news is that Roo just needs a course of antibiotics. I say, are you sure about that? It looks like something that's just been coughed up by an owl. She says, yes, hamsters respond very quickly to antibiotics. It's going to cost a bit more because I'm going to have to do a biopsy. I said, yeah, of course, that's fine. How much? And she said, £150. I said, £150? He cost me seven. I could buy a suitcase filled with hamsters for that. I could buy a suitcase made out of hamsters for that. And now the vet's looking a little bit disappointed in me. My daughter's looking really disappointed in me. My future funeral is starting to look a little different. Church isn't quite as busy as it was earlier. And my daughter does a very brief speech. I remember the day my mother murdered my hamster. And then my phone pings in my pocket. Bing! And I say to the vet, I'm sorry, this is important. I'm going to have to take this outside. It's not. I just want to leave the room. I go outside. You see, on the other side of planet Earth in Australia, it's a Friday night. And my brother has just texted me a picture of himself at a party. He's dressed as one of the Dukes of Hazzard. No one else in the background seems to be dressed up. Oh, he loves fancy dress. He's clearly off his face. And underneath the picture, the text message simply says, "Yee-haw." See, my brother and I loved The Dukes of Hazzard when we were growing up. That was our favourite show. We watched it every week. And every week, it was exactly the same episode. Same story every time. There would be a spurious reason for a car chase. There'd be a collision. The car'd flip in the air. The people in the car would struggle to get free of the car. Then they'd run. And then, boom, the car would explode. And suddenly, we rewind back in time, back to 1980. I'm 4 years old. And I'm sitting in the back of a Volvo station wagon. I'm being driven to school. It's early morning. My mum's in the front seat. She's driving. And I'm sitting in the back seat. That's me, my brother Ben, and one of our neighbours called Sally. It's cold. No one's really talking much. Then we hear it. Meow. And my mum says, did I just hear a cat? We all sort of look at each other in the back seat. Just keep driving. Then we hear it again. Meow. My mum says, all right, who packed a cat? We're all in the back seat. We all check our backpacks. The only person who doesn't check their backpack is Sally. And my mum says, Sally, did you pack a cat? Sally goes, no. And her backpack goes, rawr. Sally has totally packed their cat. Yeah, it's a black moggy called Telemachus. And my mum goes, oh, for God's sake, Sally, you can't take a cat to school in a backpack. I'm going to have to take you home. And that was the moment that a car slammed into the side of us. As bad luck had it that day, a white Ford station wagon went sailing through a red light and we got T-boned at about 75 miles per hour. And the force of the impact was such that the Volvo station wagon that we were travelling in, it rocked onto its side and fell onto its roof, and we slid for about 20 metres. And the car eventually came to a stop, and all four of us were hanging upside down now, still strapped in, swinging from the roof like bats. And then my brother struggles with his seatbelt. He falls onto the roof of the car, kicks open the back window, sprints across the street, dives over a hedge, and waits for the car to explode. And the rest of that day is a blur, but I had this really clear memory. It's like a Polaroid. It must have been about an hour later because there was police and there was ambulance and there was a tow truck. And just to the side of the Volvo station wagon, my mum was sitting on the curbside and she was crying. And I remembered being really scared. And my mum looks up at me, I must have looked bewildered, and she told me that she was sorry. I didn't say anything. And then my dad arrived and his face, it was just pure fear. And he saw the car, he saw my mother, he saw me, he saw Sally. And he said to the police officer in a tone that I had never heard before, where is my son? And the police officer said, mate, he's over there behind that bush. He's been there for about an hour. My dad goes over to my mum, and my mum said what I imagine is the most said thing at accident scenes. That car came out of nowhere. And my dad said, I know, but we're all here. We are so lucky. We survived. Sally and her family eventually moved away to Melbourne. But we used to see them every year, once a year, back in the 1980s. We'd go to this place called Smith's Lake. It's by the beach. We'd rent a house, and our families would just hang out for a couple of weeks. And by the late 1980s, Sally had grown into an absolutely stunning teenager. She looked like a teenage Elle Macpherson, seriously. But here's the kicker. She was nice. I mean, she was nice to me. I was 4 years younger than her. She could have had nothing to do with me. But she was kind to me, you know? She taught me how to do cartwheels on the beach. I can still do a pretty good cartwheel. And the thing that was really, really cool for me was that she would tell me about the dates that she went on. Yeah. I mean, I'm this younger girl listening to these stories. I remember one night she told me about a date that she went on with a boy called James. And I said, "How old is he?" She said, "He's 17. I said, "He sounds amazing." She and James went to a movie, and after the movie, they caught a ferry together. And I was like, "Oh my God, this story has everything." It has a 17-year-old boy. It has public transport. Go on. And she said that at the end of the date, she said, "He kissed me on the ferry." And I said, "On the what?" She said, "On the ferry." I went, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And I said, "And did you use tongues?" She was like, "Yeah." And I said, "That's disgusting." And she said, "Trust me, when you're older, you'll like it." And I'm 41 now. I still think it's a bit gross. I saw Sally again in 2010. Her family threw a really big party for her. And I went to the party with my mum and my dad and my brother Ben. He was dressed up as Shaft. There was nothing anywhere on the invite about dressing up. And Sally's parents had thrown this party for her because she was in remission. She'd had cancer, she'd had chemo, and she'd had radio, and she was in the all clear. And it was this fantastic party. Her hair was growing back. She was still very skinny and pale. She was still the most beautiful woman in the room. And we hadn't seen each other since these holidays back in the 1980s. She was like, "My God, wow, how are the cartwheels coming on?" I said, "I don't really do them anymore." We sort of kept on chatting, and I said to her, "I've got to ask you, do you remember about a date that you told me that you went on? It was back in the 1980s, you told me about a date that you went on with a boy called James." And she said, "No, I don't remember that." I said, "Yes, you told me about a date, it was with a boy called James, he was 17, you went to a movie and then he kissed you on the ferry." And she said, "On the what?" I said, "On the ferry." And she went, "Oh, yeah, yeah." She said, "Wait, hang on, I do. I totally remember that." I said, "Yes. And you told me all about kissing and kissing with tongues. And you said that when I was older that I would like it." "Yeah, I know, that's me making chit-chat at a party." And she said, "Oh, and do you like it?" I said, "Oh, I don't know. Sometimes I think it's a bit gross. What about you? Do you like it?" She said, "Yeah." She said, "I like kissing. I like cooking. I like cycling, because I'm here to do it." She said, "When I first got diagnosed, I couldn't understand why this had happened to me. But now, everything feels kind of special. Feels like a gift, because I survived." And she said, "Do you remember that car crash we had?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "We were so lucky. I mean, we should have died that day." She said, "That car came out of nowhere." Sarah, cars come out of nowhere all the time. And I said, "Well, they certainly do if you pack a frickin' cat in the car." She said, "Try to lighten up." And suddenly we fast forward in time, and it's the year 2016. I'm back on the other side of planet Earth. I'm 40 years old. I'm in South London. I'm in my car. It's a Volvo station wagon, 2000 model, and I'm having a panic attack. And I keep repeating the sentence, "Try to lighten up, come on, try to lighten up. Try to lighten up, come on." I got my son sitting in the car with me. He's 3.5 years old at the time. I've got this thing that I do when I'm in the car with my kids. I always try to play them classic albums. It feels like a really good opportunity to educate them musically. But I always try to make something really dramatic happen so that they'll remember it. Because in my opinion, the only way to really make a memory rock solid is to associate it with either pain or fear. So we'll be driving along and I'll just slam the brakes on for absolutely no reason at all. I'll be like, ah! Oh my God, are you kids okay? This album is Heroes by David Bowie. It's part of the Berlin Trilogy, children. And on this particular day, the album that I'm listening to is my favourite album of all time. It's Highway to Hell by AC/DC. I love it. It reminds me of being young and smoking cigarettes, dating boys who saved up for SG Gibson guitars. And then all of a sudden, I think I shouldn't have put this album on today because now I'm going to associate my favourite album with today and today's going to be a bad day. And then I think, good day, bad day, who can tell? And I switch the music off. And my son, he's 3.5 years old, he's sitting next to me, he's playing with an astronaut, a little toy astronaut. He loves space. And I say to him, are you ready, mate? And he says, it's an astronaut. And I say, good boy. Because he's right. It's an astronaut. We get out of the car and we cross the street and we go into the clinic. And they don't make us wait for very long. And the specialist comes down and meets us. She's really nice. I like her instantly. And we go up the stairs and we go into this room. As soon as I walk in, it's too hot. It's too sunny. I feel all clammy. And there are all these toys laid out. And suddenly I feel really guilty, you know, like this is entrapment. Because my son sees the toys and he thinks the toys are there to play with. But they're not. They're instruments to measure him. And they sit down. The specialist starts playing some games with my son. At first he's doing okay. But then, on top of the toy cupboard, he spots a toy space shuttle. He loves space. It's a Lego replica of the Challenger space shuttle. The Challenger space shuttle, the one from 1986 that disintegrated 73 seconds after takeoff. And my son goes to the base of the cupboard and he says, I want the space shuttle, please, mummy. I want the space shuttle, please. And I try to get him away from the base of the cupboard, but it doesn't work. He goes straight back to the base. And he says, space shuttle goes into space. And I say, good boy, because he's right. Space shuttles go into space. He's too worked up. And he accidentally pushes the toy cupboard and the Lego Challenger space shuttle comes loose and it sails through the air and it hits the ground and it disintegrates on impact. My son's bereft. I can't calm him down. And the specialist invites us to go downstairs, chill out for a moment. So we do. And in the waiting room, there's a big TV screen. And on the TV screen, there's an episode of Peppa Pig. And in this particular episode, Peppa Pig is in a classroom with Danny Dog, Susie Sheep, Zoe Zebra, Freddy Fox. And I remembered thinking, if that classroom happened in the real world, it would be an absolute bloodbath. We're called back in and we go upstairs and I'm given the diagnosis I knew I was going to get. My son's on the autism spectrum. And I start crying. Instantly, I start crying. And the doctor tells me that everything's going to be okay. And I say, how do you know everything's going to be okay? You don't know everything's going to be okay. I don't know everything's going to be okay. And then my crying, it starts to grow and build. It becomes too much. My son, who has difficulty interpreting emotions, even he's looking at me like, you might want to bring this shit down a notch. And in one sentence, I feel like my son's future has vanished and I want to vanish with it. But then my son goes over to the toy bin and he pulls out a little plastic model of the planet Saturn and he hands it to me and he says to himself, it's Saturn. And I say, good boy, because he's right. It's Saturn. And the doctor says to me, you know, you will survive this. I know you think this is a bad thing, but this is not necessarily a bad thing. And I say, who can tell, right? And on our way out, she stops me. She says, wait, had you ever thought about getting him a pet? Pets are great for kids on the autism spectrum. And I say, I don't know. It just seems like a lot of work. She says, nah, get him a hamster. She said, they sleep all the time and they're completely odorless. And we cross the street I go back to my Volvo station wagon and I sit down on the curbside and I start crying. Exactly like my mum in 1980. I'm sitting on the curb and I'm crying next to a Volvo station wagon. Except my Volvo is the right way up. It's just my world that's turned upside down. What I want to do right now is do exactly what my brother Ben did in 1980. I want to run a safe distance from this and watch it all safely from behind a bush. And I look up at my son, he looks bewildered. And I tell him that I'm sorry. And then he says, "Why is mummy crying?" And I'm suddenly so angry at myself because I don't know how to behave. There is absolutely nothing about me, either personally or professionally, that has ever been about being a positive person. And now this has come into my life out of nowhere, and it requires me to be better than that, and I don't know how to do it. And my son is standing in front of me, and he wants to know why I am crying. I am not having my boy think that he is something to be sad about. And so I look him in the eye, and I say, "Mummy is crying because the doctor kicked me." And suddenly we rewind back in time. It's 2006. I'm 30 years old. I'm at my parents' house in Australia. They've sold the house and they're moving out in 1 week. I'm sitting in a room full of old boxes and files that need to be cleared. On top of one of the boxes is a Polaroid from my brother's 6th birthday in 1979. He's dressed entirely in tinfoil and he's smiling with a cat in his lap. In front of him, there's a birthday cake that looks like a scrotum on fire. And underneath the photo is a collection of old documents from a solicitor. My mum is really emotional about moving house. This is the house where we planted a Christmas tree in the front garden in 1979. The house where our pets are buried. The house where our Volvo station wagon was once parked out the front. The house where mum and dad built a life together. And I say to my mum, "Why are you crying?" And she says, "It's the end of an era." And I remind her that she's only moving two doors down the street. Into the house on the other side of Mike and Narelle. Mike and Narelle are my parents' neighbours and worst enemies. They're greedy, covetous, and obnoxious, and without them, my parents would be simply lost. They're like a magnetic center our family is destined to orbit. And Narelle wonders out loud if the people who have bought our house will cut down that bloody 18-foot Christmas tree. She's always hated that tree. It's grown completely out of control, leaves needles everywhere, and I can see Mum's mind working overtime. She's just gonna plant another one on the other side of them. Before she's even unpacked a box. But I get back to the collection of old documents from the solicitor. The man in question was 57 at the time. His name was Donald Reagan. I know, I'm already thinking, what was his life like? How often did he have to say, "No, Donald, not Ronald"? Yeah. Donald Reagan was with his nephew, Ronald Trump. I'm joking. His nephew's name is Shane Lawrence. Shane was 14 at the time of the report. And Shane describes the banal events that morning. Everyone had slept in, they're running late. Shane had to be at the train station for a school field trip. His uncle Donald Reagan dropped by the house to pick up a key, and he offered to take his nephew to the train station. They were in such a rush, Shane nearly forgot his thermos. Luckily, his mother, Hillary Twinton, I'm gonna stop. His mother remembered the thermos at the last moment. He then describes events that must have taken no more than 2 seconds. He describes a red traffic light, his uncle Donald Reagan attempting to hit the brakes, and the horrible realization that that thermos he nearly forgot to bring had rolled under the brake pedal, making it impossible to depress. Through the sounds of metal crunching and glass exploding, Shane can now see the faces of the people in the vehicle that they've just driven into, and the car flips. Shane drifts in and out of consciousness over the next hour at the scene of the crash. He describes the scene in patchy detail. Police and ambulance arrive, a tow truck. Shane sees a little girl with red hair. She's trying to comfort her mother. Her mother is sobbing on the curbside. And then Shane describes the last thing that he remembers that day. He's lying on a stretcher, watching what he thinks must be a dream. A beautiful little girl with a blonde plait is sobbing. She unzips her backpack and a black cat leaps 11 feet in the air. And now we're back in 2018. I'm back on the other side of planet Earth. I'm in my house in London. I'm going to be 42 years old soon. And it's the dead of night. The clock says 17 minutes past one. I'm coming back from the toilet. And I look into Roo's cage. He's sitting at his bus stop wide awake, waiting for the bus that's never coming to get him. I reach in and I pick him up. I put the little plastic syringe in his mouth. I give him his shot of antibiotics. Yes, I got him the antibiotics. I'm not a hamster murderer. And I've just trodden in a Kinder Egg, so I peel some off my foot and I give it to him as a chaser. And I am exactly 2 weeks away from being told by my vet that chocolate is toxic to hamsters. And the lounge room looks like a bomb has gone off in it. My son has left the planets of the solar system littered around the place. And my kids have been wrestling on the couch earlier that day. You know, they've been fighting. When I walked into the room, my daughter landed this punch on my son's arm. You know, so I go into mum mode. I went, "Hey, what do you say?" And my son said, "Thank you." And we've started doing this thing with him called social stories. See, kids on the autism spectrum, they don't naturally intuit social behaviour. So we're teaching him through story. It's incredible. He's learning things like eye contact, answering when he's spoken to talk and speak and have conversation. And as he gets older, we'll use these social stories to explain far more complicated things. We'll use stories to explain things like understanding frustration, dealing with emotions like sadness or loneliness. And I realise that for both my son and I, stories are a lifeline. They are our roadmap for navigating life. And my daughter has left her assignment out on the kitchen table. She has to do a speech on any topic, and the topic she's chosen is hamsters. And I read through what she and I wrote together earlier that evening. "I have a hamster." She spelled hamster with a P. "His name is Roo, and I love him, even though he smells like toilets at a music festival." Yes, okay, I wrote that bit. Okay. "Hamsters come from Syria. They were hunted until nearly all of them were dead. This is called extinct. In 1930, a nice man found a mummy hamster with her babies in Aleppo, Syria. He took them to Jerusalem, and some of them ran away. All hamsters today are descended from this mummy hamster. If the man hadn't saved the mummy, there would be no hamsters at all." And I scratch Roo behind the ear. I like his story because it's a story about survival. It's about being positive. And I start cleaning up the planets of the solar system. I feel like some music. So I put on Highway to Hell. Still my favorite album. Australian Trilogy was written by Sarah Kendall and Carl Cooper. It was performed by Sarah Kendall, produced by Carl Cooper. It was a BBC Studios production.